Hello and welcome to this third episode of the podcast series Help Me Understand. My name is Yid and this is a podcast where I help other people and students like myself understand why things are the way they are in society. And this episode will be hosted by my fellow student Erica Pasco. So hello and welcome to you, Erica.
Hi everyone, so today I'm going to be talking to an LSE professor, Charlie Beckett, who also has a journalism background, and we're going to be discussing disinformation. This is something that's relevant to people all around the world, but it's not a subject that people understand a great deal about. So in this episode, I'm going to dive further into the topic of disinformation in order to understand its threats to society and the most useful methods to combat it. Hello and welcome to Help Me Understand, Charlie. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
So firstly, could you tell us a bit about yourself and your professional background?
Sure. I was, by career, a journalist. I worked my way up from local newspapers to London television station called LWT. And then I spent about a decade at the BBC and also at ITN's Channel 4 News. And I joined the LSE back in 2006 to set up POLIS, which is the LSE's international journalism think tank. And of course, I'm a professor in the Department of Media and Communications.
Great. Well, I think before our discussion, it's important to give an overview of the term disinformation for our listeners, because I know there's been some confusion over the term, particularly in relation to misinformation and also fake news, which kind of floats around as well. So that would be really helpful if you could give a brief overview.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, bad information is as old as information itself. So it's always been part of human communication. There are always people, frankly, who will make up things or lie or distort things or perhaps create propaganda. So there's lots of different kinds of disinformation. You could say that something like satire is a form of disinformation because it's people exaggerating for comic effect. It's not the truth. But then there's more serious disinformation, for example, propaganda, people lying for a reason, usually a political reason. Now, some of that can be quite innocent. It can be spin, for example, which is a kind of manipulation, or rhetoric, which is a kind of way of speaking to persuade people. So there's lots of different categories of disinformation, misinformation, and so on.
And so are there any particular examples, like famous examples of disinformation being spread that you can think of, just to bring a bit of context for people?
Sure. Well, this, as I mentioned, this predates the internet. There was a famous example in the 1980s, the so-called Hitler diary scandal, when a con man created a beautiful Hitler's diaries. They looked completely genuine and they fooled the very clever editors at the British newspaper, The Sunday Times, who published them with great fanfare. We have got Hitler's diaries, and it turned out to be a fraud. So that's a great example of a very deliberate act of disinformation. But much more recently, it's been about what spreads on the internet, the so-called fake news.
Yeah, so I was going to ask you about that because, you know, I know that you worked as a journalist a while ago, and I think, you know, it's important to address social media's role in the spread of disinformation. And so I was going to ask you, in the time that you were working as a journalist, whether you had encountered yourself, like, was the term widely used back then or not?
Not so much, although there was a phrase that don't believe everything you read in the newspapers. It used to be journalists who were accused of misinformation and, of course, politicians. And that's true. You know, journalists stretch the truth. It's a form, it's a kind of profession of the imperfect. It's a race against deadlines, a race against time to try and piece together what's happening in the world. And sometimes disinformation happens through mistake. You get your facts wrong, you don't know everything. And sometimes it's because you're biased, you ignore the facts that are inconvenient to your truth. But social media and the internet has changed this profoundly. Partly, many journalists are now seen as good guys who are trying to fight some of this, with fact-checking, for example. But it's the internet that has enabled anybody, to have a voice, to put content online. And a lot of that is wonderful, isn't it? It's lovely. Social media, we can talk to each other, share our experiences, share educational information for people. But along with that, there'll always be accidental and deliberate disinformation. The difference is it spreads so quickly, oftentimes spread by the technology, through bots, for example, who can just automatically churn out disinformation, but also by us. We share stuff without checking it. We like something without really checking or reading it. We act on impulse and emotions. And the fact is that you can share that information so rapidly. And we can see that disinformation seems to spread much, much, much more quickly than real and good information.
I read in, you know, a previous blog post by yourself that you think fake news could be beneficial to journalism as it gives mainstream journalism outlets the opportunity to show, you know, the quality and like the expertise and ethics. But what if you aren't engaging with, you know, young audiences, for example, and they resort to social media for their news instead? Do you think this is the responsibility of news organisations to counter this, or actually should it be the tech firms that try and combat this instead?
Well, I don't want to leave it all up to the tech firms, partly because I don't trust them, but I also don't think they have the expertise or the ethics to edit the world's information. So it's certainly down to the news media. And we saw during the pandemic where people turned to traditional media around the world because they wanted something more reliable, more authoritative, because they had to make such important decisions during the pandemic, and it was so worrisome, wasn't it? So there's a big boom for traditional media because it was at least better than a lot of, or a bit more trustworthy than a lot of the nonsense out there. So it is good for business, for the journalism business. It's also good, I would argue, for universities, for example. If they are, you know, the LSE is a media organisation. It produces vast amounts of media content every day based, you hope, on good, sound, critical research. So that's an important role for institutions like universities to try and help people find better information out there. And, you know, there is a huge demand for this disinformation. We all love stuff that's actually too good to be true. It usually isn't true. But also people, when they have to make tough decisions about their jobs, about their education, about their health, about their mental health, then they need good information. So I think there's a good business case.
I mean, it's a really interesting time right now for media policy, with the Online Safety Bill in its final stages. And for those who don't know what that is, it's a new set of laws to protect children and adults online, which, if passed, will make social media companies more responsible for user safety on their platforms. And so this bill at the moment is focused on reducing the spread of illegal content, such as sexual images of children, hate crime and terrorism. But as I understand, tech companies are no longer responsible for the removal of legal but harmful content online. You know, this is removed from the bill after concerns for freedom of expression rights. So my question here is, do you think that the Online Safety Bill should be tackling legal but harmful content such as disinformation? I know that you said that you don't want to give too much power to tech companies, and I see completely that side of things, but you know, children can be particularly affected by this type of thing and easily persuaded if they're not reading legitimate news sources.
No, indeed. I mean, and not just news, as I said, around health, for example. I think that's one of the most obvious cases where, you know, media can cause harm. When you think of, you know, young girls and the pressure they're on around body shape and diet and so on. So I think it's quite legitimate for society to protect people from harm. So, for example, in the UK, we have rules around seatbelts if you're driving a car. You know, cars have to be safe and they have to be checked every year. So I don't have any objection to trying to use regulation to protect people. But I think, speaking as a journalist especially, I'm very concerned about edging into an area where we're trying to shape speech more generally, when we're straying away from, you know, from harmful to perhaps undesirable speech. So I think we should always err on the side of allowing stuff that, you know, you or I might not like, we may even find offensive, but other people feel is valid. And I think that's really important to an open society. And I think we can panic sometimes. I remember being in the States after the 2016 election, and all the liberals I spoke to, especially the liberal journalists, were absolutely panicking because Donald Trump had been elected, and there was a vast amounts of fake news spreading, it seemed, like wildfire. And people made the link and said, well, that's why he got elected. And I think that's mistaken. You know, subsequent research has shown that, yes, there's a lot of disinformation and new technologies are always coming along to help people to spread it. But there's also lots of evidence that it doesn't actually have much impact, for example, on elections. And people are perhaps getting better at spotting it. And people are getting better at finding sources that they like. I think what you raised, the bigger problem, is people who feel overwhelmed by all the information, some of it good, some of it bad, and they give up. They say, well, look, I'm just going to avoid the news. I'm going to avoid finding information. I'm just going to, you know, go by my instincts and my emotions. And I think that's more concerning more generally. And I don't think you can solve that by regulation. I think that's much more a question of, you know, building media literacy, building better news media, for example.
It's really interesting that you mention news avoidance, just because a lot of young people are overwhelmed with so much online and they are questioning what is true and what is factual.
There must be days or hours when you just think, I can't bear it anymore.
Yeah.
I'm just going to get off my phone. I'm just going to, you know, stay away from the screens because I'm, I don't know, depressed by it. I need a break, or I feel a bit confused by it.
No, yeah, totally. I definitely agree with that. And I think you're completely right in saying that media literacy is a way forward in terms of, you know, educating young people on how to select and what is maybe more sinister out there. In terms of the sinister side of disinformation, I did read some academic scholarship on bots and potential Russian interference with the 2016 US presidential election. And it's really hard to prove, isn't it? And who holds these people accountable? Because there's no international standard necessarily.
The Russians, for example, and the Chinese, and probably the Americans, are investing a lot of money in disinformation. And sometimes it's quite clever. It's not pumping out fake news as such. It's often trying to flood memes or flood social media spaces with kind of positive angles on a particular issue to try and drown out the criticism. So they obviously think it works, and I'm not saying it doesn't have any impact at all, but the evidence is that it doesn't really swing things much. If you think about it, you know, Russians intervening in an American election, it'd be very difficult to, you know, convert somebody from being, I don't know, a Democrat to a Republican with a few tweets. It really isn't that easy. And the evidence is that it didn't have much impact. You see the numbers of how many tweets and how many bots, and it looks absolutely frightening. But the actual qualitative research suggests, at least, that people are much more influenced by other factors than they are by, I don't know, something they saw on TikTok or Instagram.
And speaking about the dangers such as bots, and I know you say that it's quite a small likelihood that they can entirely influence political events, but what about the consequences? Do you think there should be consequences for people that spread disinformation? You know, in terms of vaccines, for example, there was a huge anti-vaxxer movement and people are going against government advice.
I think the sort of the vaccine one's a really interesting example. I have a theory, it's difficult to prove it, that the anti-vaxxers, certainly in the UK, were not very effective. And it was partly because every time they put their bonkers stuff online, they got so ridiculed by people. People would share a lot of it, but partly to say, look at these crazy people and these crazy things they're saying. So perversely, they might actually have damaged their own nefarious cause. But I do think that is an interesting example of where it could cause harm. Now, what do you do about that? You're suggesting that you might actually prosecute people. I can see there's a reason for that. We do prosecute people in the UK, for example, for spreading inflammatory race hatred and inciting violence. These are illegal things. And so certainly you should be prosecuted. Although I don't particularly want to have the police spending all their time on Twitter looking for dodgy tweets. But I think there's something that the platforms themselves can do more to filter. And we've seen, you know, with Elon Musk taking over Twitter and what a shambles it is and how the moderation has completely broken down there. And so you do have this much more of a Wild West on Twitter, for example. And the fact is that a lot of people have left Twitter or don't use it as much because of that. So funnily enough, it's kind of backfired for Elon by him, you know, allowing this sort of unrestrained speech. Now, obviously, you know, the model, it's very difficult for to define, you know, what you think is speech that should be disallowed or restricted. You know, it can all be done secretly in the algorithm, or it can be done overtly through terms and conditions and so on, and through the kind of moderation which I thought was working reasonably well on platforms like Twitter, where, you know, you would get a warning, you may get suspended briefly, but you had a right of appeal. There's a kind of process there. So I'm not completely laissez-faire. I don't think, you know, we have created these platforms, we've created these information systems, so we can create them in ways that we think are more socially beneficial than they are.
Do you think that fact checkers go far enough, as some people, you know, can avoid their detection online with the use of emojis or, you know, to replace text?
It's a kind of arms race, isn't it? You can always find clever ways to avoid detection if you want to. But certainly I've got nothing against the idea of checking facts. I think we should all be fact checkers, and there's a lot of good evidence that, you know, there's a lot of great forensic work being done by fact checking organisations. Some of them are using technology in very clever ways to help filter out bad information and fake news. But, you know, and if you think about it, we are here at the LSE, which is in a sense a giant fact checking organisation. But as you know, as an LSE student, oftentimes we say, well, actually, the facts are more complicated than you think. And that's the trouble, that it's easy to see that something is wildly inaccurate or false, but so much of it is in the grey zone. And as a journalist, you know, I spent a lot of time, and indeed as an academic, operating in that grey zone, having to make editorial judgments about, well, do we think this is true or do we think this is accurate? And often it was literally debatable. Some people will have a different way of framing something, they'll have a different interpretation of something. So you've got to allow those that plurality, if you like. And so you can't fact check things to a point of perfection. And I think that would be wildly undesirable as well.
No, I do see what you're saying there, particularly, you know, in a democracy, you know, we have people have the right to as freely express themselves. And
yeah, and we've just been through it with this Gary Lineker saga, you know, with the, you know, a BBC, a freelance sports presenter of the BBC who had tweeted about a government immigration bill, and he had made perhaps a slightly inflammatory comparison with 1930s Germany. I mean, factually, he was quite right. The language was reminiscent of 1930s Germany, but in the context, it was extremely controversial. Half the country agree with Gary, and so they think that what he said was true. The other half don't agree with Gary, so they think what he said was untrue. And the poor old BBC had to make a judgment about what they were going to do with Gary Lineker being so impartial, you know, so if you like, biased. I don't have a problem with bias. You know, I think bias is wonderful. It just means you've got an opinion about something. But if you've got a position of responsibility, like an academic or a journalist, then you need to be aware of your biases.
And so with the Gary Lineker saga, I mean, there's this whole debate now about whether journalists should be more, you know, personable in a way. And in a way, it's probably he's more in touch with his audience, because I know that he's a sports presenter, but a lot of people are probably agreeing with him in that sense. And
yeah, it's a shame in a way, because the whole Lineker Ferrari, which must be seem very strange to some of the students who are not from the UK. They think, what, we must have gone mad here. And it's a shame that we've not been talking about the actual bill, you know, the law that they're proposing, rather, and the issues around it. But on the other hand, Lineker has got everyone talking about that. They're sort of saying, well, is it a fascist piece of legislation or not? What should we really do about asylum seekers in the UK? So in a funny kind of way, as you say, he got everyone engaged in that issue, which is a very tough thing to do. And I think personally, you know, I think that is part of journalism's job. It's to engage people, to bring these interesting different perspectives to bear so people will respond. But it's a very fine line between that and sort of sensationalism, the kind of Andrew Tate, you know, extremism that deliberately provokes and insults, mainly, I think, just to get attention and earn him money. And, you know, I personally think he's vile, but he's also very effective at getting people engaged and talking about things.
I mean, with people as extreme as Andrew Tate, I mean, there's also concern for conspiracy theorists online as well. And I recently watched a documentary about the MH370 plane that disappeared.
It's great, wasn't it? I enjoyed that one.
Yeah, really good. And, you know, this question of how we strike the balance between free speech, you know, people are entitled to their own opinions, but what is dangerously false information in a sense? Because if it's not based on data or, I don't know, scientific evidence, people do tend to question the validity.
Well, I thought the example you gave of that, you know, the documentary about the airliner was a good one, actually, because it did go through the different scenarios. So it was acknowledging that people have different theories about something, but it did it in the best to its best ability to get ground it in some kind of factual analysis. And I think this is important to remember that, you know, one person's firmly held belief is another person's wacky conspiracy theory. I mean, you only have to think about religion. You know, there's some very curious myths around, you know, for example, the wonderful religion of Christianity, about some guy being reborn and so on. It seems a bit crazy.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem very fact-based, but religion is still very, very important to people. So it's valid to them. And I think that's the same with conspiracy theories. You know, I think they're incredibly attractive. I don't know about you, but I love reading conspiracy theories because it's just a wonderful sort of fairy tale. And it's usually based on wishful thinking and it's usually based on very incomplete knowledge. What's disturbing about it is, well, two things. One, when you get to the bottom of most conspiracy theories, they always end up with anti-Semitism. They end up with some vile hate at their core. In that sense, you know, I hate to invoke the Nazis, but, you know, Nazi ideology was a conspiracy theory. It believed that, you know, world Jewry was, you know, going to bring down the Aryan race. And look what happened with that. So there are real harms caused by specific conspiracy theories. We saw, you know, the January 6th event in Washington. But also, I think it's more generally, it's kind of worrisome in the sense that it allows people to escape, I suppose, from reality, to escape from reason. Now, you know, there's more to us than just facts. We're all human, emotional people. We love narratives. So I'm not saying, you know, that it's wrong to have imagination and creativity. But this is definitely a real problem.
Well, I think we've had a great discussion here about the whole topic of disinformation, and there's plenty of other factors within it. But just to kind of round off today, what would you say are the main methods for tackling disinformation? So, A, do you think it needs to be done? And B, what do you think is the future of it? Do you think it's, as you say, fact-checking is the way forward? Or do we need to hold tech companies more responsible for facilitating the spread?
Kind of try anything if you like. I mean, we did a big commission back in 2018 called the Truth, Trust and Technology Commission, which I was leading. And it was interesting. My colleagues ended up being quite cautious about bringing in regulation, not just because of freedom of expression, but they weren't sure how it would work. You know, you could regulate the internet by turning it into a newspaper so that everything had to be checked before you could put anything online. Now, you know, and I know, that would just be utterly impossible and very undesirable. But that's the only way if you really want to get rid of so-called fake news. And in one sense, I would say, first of all, relax, take a deep breath. You know, the world isn't going to end because of disinformation, or at least I hope not. And so much of it, I think, you should take a kind of personal view. I try hard. I could give you a lecture about how everyone ought to fact check, everyone ought to read a serious news site, everyone ought to go and get some more media literacy lessons and all that kind of stuff. Yes, all that's great. But I think the starting point is checking your priors. It's actually thinking, do I just disagree with this, or is it really disinformation? I don't particularly like what I'm reading, but do I really want it removed from the world? And also, when I share things, do I check what I'm sharing? Do I think about, you know, where I get my information from? So I think we should start with ourselves, to be honest. Not, I don't want to make the individual responsible. Of course, it's all about the tech companies. It's all about government and regulation as well. It is about things like universities being supported, a better education system and so on. But if you're going to wait for everyone to be super clever and literate and sensible, I think you're going to be waiting a very long time. Meanwhile, there is a lot of weird disinformation out there. And I think we just have to start with our own diet, a bit like, you know, with food. You can regulate food system, you can make the supermarkets, reduce the price of healthy food and so on. But in the end, it's partly about you. Are you going to eat that burger, or are you going to have that lovely kale?
Well, I think that's a great note to end on. And thank you, Charlie. It's great to have you in the studio. And thank you for helping us understand a bit more about disinformation.
It's been lovely. Thank you very much.